Catherine Tufariello writes exquisitely chiseled gems, sonnets, pantoums, blank verse narratives, rhymed quatrains, villanelles, you name it. We met as fellows several years ago at the Suwannee Writers' Conference, and after her morning reading, a few mopey fellows were sitting at lunch before our own readings that afternoon when poet Andrew Hudgens leaned in and said, "Catherine Tufariello has set the bar high, boys and girls. She set that bar real high." As if we didn't know. Nobody wanted to follow her. Catherine combines perfectly both sound and sense, as if she had no idea most poets threw that idea out in the middle of last century. Sound and sense, together again at last. Her poems marry the musical with the accessible, probing an impossible wide range of subjects: family, motherhood, art, the city, modern history, the Italian Renaissance, not to forget two favorites, guinea worms and internet spam, all handled with delicate precision and passion, logic, and art. Catherine Tufariello has won the prestigious Poets Prize for her first poetry collection, Keeping My Name, right here, which was a Walt MacDonald first book series and poetry winner. The book was also named a Los Angeles Times Book Award finalist and a Book List Editor's Pick. Her poems have appeared in the Hudson Review, Poetry, River Styx, Tar River Poetry, and many other magazines and anthologies. Please welcome, from Valparaiso, Indiana, via Buffalo, New York City, and Cornell, my dear friend and scrupulous tough love critic, not to mention an exceptional fixer of toilets, 2 in 1 day, Catherine Tufariello.
Thank you, Richard. It's great to be here. This is my first visit to St. Louis, and I'm having such a wonderful time. Valparaiso is a great town. I love it, but we don't have Ethiopian restaurants there. And I've been eating such wonderful food, and I hope next time I come back I can stay longer. As for fixing the toilets, it was all research for my new manuscript, Plumbing for Poets. Some of you, I'm sure, know that if you're a poet, the bar as far as doing anything practical is very low. So if you can even make the slightest adjustment to plumbing and it works, people are in awe. So there's something very satisfying about it. I'm going to start with a poem I wish I'd written, but I didn't. This is by Tom Gunn. It's one of my favorite poems of his. It's from The Man with Night Sweats, which, as many of you know, is a collection of elegies, mostly for friends of his who died of AIDS. They're just devastatingly powerful elegies. And then in the middle of all these very intensely grief-filled poems, you get this poem about a flower. And in the Midwest, spring is coming so late, and we've all been longing for it so much. I thought this would be a good one to read. It's called Nasturtium. Born in a sour waste lot, you labored up to light, bunching what strength you'd got and running out of sight through a knothole at last, to come forth into sun as if without a past, done with it, rebegun. Now street side of the fence, you take a few green turns, nimble in nonchalance before your first flower burns. From poverty and prison and undernourishment, a prodigal has risen, self-spending, never spent. Irregular yellow shell and drooping spur behind, not rare, but beautiful, street handsome, as you wind and leap, hold after hold, a golden runaway, still running, strewing gold from side to side all day. I'm going to read a few poems from my book, Keeping My Name, and then read some more recent work. This is the first poem in the book. It's called Free Time. And Richard suggested I read it tonight, and I know why. It's because it's the only poem I've written having something to do with basketball. So I'm reading this for him. When my first apartment in Brooklyn was right next door to a middle school, and the living room windows on the third floor looked out over this enclosed asphalt courtyard where the kids would have recess and play games, usually basketball, though occasionally other games too. And I would sit there trying to work on poems in the morning before going to work, and the noise and the hubbub outside the window was such that sometimes I would give up and just watch them. This came out of that. Free time. Their shrieks careening dizzily between delight and outrage. The students in the yard are playing hard, though they have little room and nothing green in their asphalt pen. Nothing but fences, bricks, and at regulation height, a pair of hoops from which gray loops vestigially descend. With graceful flicks, they pass, block, feint, and argue fouls, and all the while a staccato, meaty thwack, now quick, now slack, thrums on, a backbeat to their cheers and howls. Three stories up on her habitual perch, a black and white cat observes the scene, brushing the screen with down-curved whiskers, wrapped in scan and search, as though the swirl below were birds or fish. In the cacophony, it seems she hears the singing spheres, each ear a separately tuning radar dish. I join her at the window, and together we watch the game until the tardy bell, whose clanging knell recalls them, some still wrangling over whether the last shot counted. In the sudden peace, a handyman, belt slung with rules and hammers, appears and clambers onto the gym roof, while a scrawl of geese ripples on windy gray in ragged flight. He gathers up the balls that got away and spent the day aimlessly free, red, orange, purple, white, and punts them in bright arcs back into play. This is a poem out of my own childhood. It's called Chemist's Daughter. I'm one of four daughters, and our father was for many years a chemist and a professor of chemistry at the University of Buffalo. And when we were young, he liked to tell us interesting little chemical facts about the world. And when we were very, very young, I remember being told, that everything you can see in the world is made of these invisible particles you can't see called atoms. And you know, atoms are mostly composed of the space between the subatomic particles. Who would tell us, well, theoretically it could happen that the leg of that table could fuse with the floor if the atoms align just right. Or another example I remember was that it could randomly happen that all the oxygen atoms in a room could end up in one corner and suddenly wouldn't be able to breathe. He denies now that he told us this, but I was an imaginative child, and this made a big impression on me, and so this poem came out of that. Chemist's daughter. Thumping the dinner table, Dad would say, it too was atoms, massed in galaxies made mainly of empty space. At night, the bee's drone of electrons woke me. A Milky Way was whirling on the tip of my fingernail, 10,000 planets dancing on its pale half moon. Would bed, desk, dresser lose their grip on the braided rug? Outside was empty space, dark deserts stretched between the yellow face of the moon and our backyard, where I would slip through glittering snow crust, playing astronaut. The world looked solid. It was wild as thought. This one is from a sequence of poems in keeping my name about infertility. Some of you, I'm sure, know from experience that if you've been married for a few years and haven't yet had a baby, all kinds of people, from dear friends and family members to casual acquaintances and complete strangers, will start to take an interest in it and get concerned and want to give you advice. This is samples of that advice, and it's all dialogue, and I'm not much good at doing voices, so everybody's going to kind of sound the same, I'm afraid, but it doesn't really matter in this case. Useful advice. You're 37? Don't you think that maybe it's time you settled down and had a baby? No wine? Does this mean happy news? I knew it. Hey, are you sure you two know how to do it? All Dennis has to do is look at me and I'm knocked up. Some things aren't meant to be. It's sad, but try to see this as God's will. I've heard that sometimes when you take the pill, a friend of mine got pregnant when she stopped working so hard. Why don't you two adopt? You'll have one of your own then, like my niece. At work, I heard about this herb from Greece. My sister swears by Dong Quai. Want to try it? Forget the high-tech stuff. Just change your diet. It's true. Too much caffeine can make you sterile. Yoga is good for that. My cousin Carol, they have these ceremonies in Peru. You mind my asking, is it him or you? Have you tried acupuncture, meditation? It's in your head. Relax. Take a vacation and have some fun. You think too much. Stop trying. Did I say something wrong? Why are you crying? This one is written for my daughter, who's now six, and it's about a nightmare she had when she was a toddler, which was the first bad dream she ever had that she could explain to me well enough that I could understand what it was. And it was uncanny and really disturbing. And she kept having this dream, and after a while, the images from this dream started following me around, too. So I had to write the poem as a way of exercising it, at least for me, if not for her. She's not having it anymore. Bete Noire. It blocked her path in the first bad dream she could make me understand. Tall and shaggy, with three dog paws and a little human hand. Unseen until here she looked at hers, describing in the air a gesture of menace or warning or welcome. Either it ended there, or else she didn't have the words to say more at not quite three. It held out its hand, she said again. It held out its hand to me. I rocked her and sang, assuring her with a mother's instinctive guile that dreams weren't real and couldn't hurt her, knowing all the while that when she slept, the tick, 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 tock of its stumbling tread would shadow me familiarly and lie down beside my bed, accosting me with its roomy eyes, its smell of damp defeat, its matted fur aseethed with fleas, its breath like rotten meat, its pitiful, imperious howl like an infant's, and, most appallingly of all, its apprehending hand. Now for something a little lighter. This one is also for Sophie, when she was a little bit older and made a sudden breakthrough in learning how to do jigsaw puzzles. She's a redhead with a very low frustration tolerance, and for a long time, we had to take the puzzles and put them away because she just would get so angry that she couldn't do it. And then she had a sudden breakthrough, and it was a puzzle with a picture of horses galloping across a meadow. Jigsaw. 6 months ago, it made her cry. Furious, looking just at shape, she tried to force a swatch of sky into the chestnut stallion's nape. But now she sees the picture, too. She chooses, studies, turns a piece, cajoling out of broken blue high mare's tail clouds and wheeling geese. And from this mottled brown infers the muzzle of the piebald foal. Intractable particulars allude to their imagined whole, a world to which she palms the key. Her guesses are no longer blind but purposeful, her strategy, patience, and insight intertwined. The red-roofed farmhouse and the rows of corn are conjured. Hills condense, and inch by inch, the meadow sows itself beneath the weathered fence. The final piece is placed and locks. Between the black mare's hooves, a plume of purple flowers, asters, phlox, and sprays of scarlet paintbrush bloom. This is a poem that's totally unlike anything else I've ever written, which I think is why it was taken for River Styx. It's a weird poem. Its subject is guinea worm disease. It's one of the ones that Richard mentioned in his introduction, which is a particularly awful parasitic disease that I started reading about when there was a lot of press a few years ago about the Carter Center's efforts to eradicate it, and I was fascinated by that story. And it's a disease that's afflicted mankind for, you know, tens of thousands, probably millions of years. I don't know. And it actually is with any luck, it looks like maybe the first parasitic disease that mankind ever completely eradicates. It's getting closer and closer. And this is the first free verse poem I've written in probably a decade. I like to work in meter and rhyme, as you can probably tell already. And I tried writing this poem in kind of complicated stanza form I made up, and it was completely dead on the page. It was a total failure. And I kept working and working at it, and I was fascinated by the subject, but I just couldn't make it work. And so I put it away for like a year and a half. And then for some reason, I reread Christopher Smart's poem, My Cat Jeffrey, which some of you probably know. This was first written when he was confined in a madhouse in the middle of the 18th century. And it was first published in 1939, so long after it was written. And all of the lines in My Cat Jeffrey begin with four. It starts off, "For I will consider my cat Jeffrey, for he is the servant of the living God, duly and daily serving him." And the whole poem is this very detailed, fanciful, loving evocation of what a cat is like, the things that the cat does. A few of my favorite lines are, "For he has the subtlety and hissing of a serpent, which in goodness he suppresses. And for he will not do destruction if he is well fed, neither will he spit without provocation. For he purrs in thankfulness when God tells him he's a good cat." And for whatever bizarre reason, this poem and the form that it was in kind of merged with this poem in this failed stanza form, and this was the result. It's called the Latin is the Latin word for guinea worm, the Latin term Dracunculus medinensis. I'm taking suggestions for better titles. I have a horrible problem with titles, and I went through like a dozen of them, and I'm still not happy with this, but anyway. "For I will consider the guinea worm, for its Latin name means little dragon, for its life cycle is remarkable to behold, for it has the ingenious improbability of the human eye or the dance of the bee or the shell's Fibonacci spirals, for its larva is a vigorous swimmer, for its thrashing attracts the water flea called Cyclops, for Cyclops engulfs it as the whale did Jonah, for it swells in the belly of Cyclops for 14 days, for a man drinks polluted water from a pond, a woman from a well, a child from the cup of her hands, for the second host's belly destroys the flea, freeing the larva inside. For it cannot destroy the larva. For it burrows through the wall of the intestine. For the male and female meet in their peregrinations. For the tiny male soon dies, but the breeding female grows. For the breeding female grows up to a cubit long. For swollen with offspring, she journeys to the body's surface. For she bides her time. For where she lodges, a burning blister erupts. For the blister breaks and exposes her at its center. I will witness the awful manner of her departing. For she prefers the legs or feet, but has been known to come forth from an eye or a tongue, from a testicle or a breast. For she reluctantly leaves her refuge, the warm labyrinth of the body. For if she is touched, she withdraws to its moist recesses. For she will emerge in water, for her young can survive only in water. For she impels the victim, maddened with pain, to plunge the ulcer in soothing water. For into the pond spills a vapor trail of a million milky spawn. I will consider how the cycle begins again and mark how it does not end. For having spawned, the dying worm must be drawn forth bit by bit, for it most resembles a bloodless vein or a strand of boiled spaghetti. For it can only be removed by winding slowly around a stick, like thread on a spool, lest it retreat again. For if the worm ruptures, a raging infection results, for its extraction takes weeks. For if all goes well, the victim lies bedridden for a month afterward. for the crops rot unpicked and the children go hungry. I will marvel at how the worm's long history is intertwined with ours, for its calcified remains have been found tangled in the legs and lungs of pharaohs, for it has been ferried by them unknowingly into the tomb and the dimness of the afterlife, for it afflicted also the Egyptians' enemies, for the Israelites accosted Moses by the shore of the Red Sea, for they complained of having been brought from slavery into a wilderness without food or water, or shelter. For they came to loathe the Lord's manna, for the Lord in retribution sent them a plague of fiery serpents. For many were bitten and died. For the survivors begged Moses to ask the Lord's forgiveness. For the Lord commanded Moses to hold up a staff with a serpent of brass, and those who looked upon it would live. For the Hebrew for fiery serpent is seraph, for seraph is the root of seraphim. For Satan, before he took the shape of a serpent, was among the seraphim. For if this scourge was created, it must surely have been by the design of Satan. For if by God, it is an argument against God's benevolence. For if not, it is a defiance against God's power. I will praise the destruction of the guinea worm and exult in its exile from the earth. For at last mankind, without the power of miracles, has lifted his sword against it. For he now knows that it is not caused by the curse of an ancestor or of God, or by drinking the blood of a goat, or by a confluence of the planets. For he has found the soft place in the dragon's belly. For he knows that it needs the water flea to breed, and without it is rendered harmless. For the fleas cannot pass through closely woven cloth. For infested water can, by this remedy, be made clean again. For he has expelled the worm from India and Pakistan, from Senegal and Yemen, from Cameroon and Kenya, one village at a time. For he has battled fear and suspicion and hopelessness and the jealousy of the local gods that guard the sacred wells. For the worm creeps nearer and nearer to extinction. For soon it shall no longer bite the heels of the children of men. For they shall drink without harm from the cups of their hands. Thank you. That was my first time reading that one, so I was a little nervous about it. The only long one. The rest of it, there's a few more in there if they're short. This one is from a sequence of verse riddles that I've been working on and off for years. I love verse riddles. I think ever since I read The Hobbit when I was 13, many of you, if you've read it, you I'm sure remember the riddle guessing contest between Bilbo Baggins and Gollum, which is a lot of fun. This is the newest one I've done, and it's based on Old English accentual form, alliterative accentual verse, like the meter of Beowulf or of the Exeter book, which is the oldest collection of riddles that we have in English. It doesn't seem fair to read you a riddle and expect you to guess it just hearing it once, so I'm going to give you a hint. The answer has to do with music. Like man, I was made half deathless, half mortal, formed of thin swan's wings or thigh bone of bear, begotten like him by a warm wind blowing, mere bone without my marrow of air. Now silver keys open my single chamber. Any can finger them. Few can unlock the wonder within it, and no one can enter. Dancers and mourners move to my clock. Riddled by man, and myself a riddler, I bear his burden and carry his breath, piercing his side with sorrow's sword, with pleasure that shivers on a sharp cliff. Does anybody want to guess? It's an instrument. Is that a flute? Yeah. This is a translation I did. There's a sequence of poems in Keeping My Name that are translations from medieval Italian love poetry. mostly sonnets by Petrarch. This one didn't go in the book because my editor put his foot down. He was really pretty lenient with me, but he said, no, this doesn't belong. It's completely different from the other translations. He thought in both subject matter and tone it didn't work. And so I reluctantly agreed to take it out. This is by a comic, realistic, satiric poet who is a contemporary of Dante. And he was born into a wealthy banking family in Siena, but he was the black sheep of the family. He was just kind of a bad boy all around. He was always in trouble with the law. He liked three things about equally: women, drinking, and gambling. And in his poems, though, women are not idealized angelic creatures. You know, he had a different kind of perspective. And he wrote poems making fun of his parents, making fun of Dante and Cavalcanti and just about everybody. He did military service in Siena, but we know that he didn't do it particularly honorably, and he kept getting fined for breaking the evening curfew. And when he died, his estate was burdened with so much debt from his gambling habit that his heirs refused their claim to it. I just think he's a really colorful, interesting figure. He wrote over 100 sonnets, and this is a translation of his most famous one. I tried to translate it as a sonnet. With Petrarch, I was able to do that. I was able to do it in iambic pentameter with a more or less Petrarchan rhyme scheme, but with this poem, I couldn't manage it. And so the lines range from trimeter to pentameter, and the rhyme scheme is just kind of all over the place, but I guess he encouraged me to bend the rules or something. If I were fire, I'd set the world aflame. If I were wind, I'd blow it down. If I were water, I'd make it drown. If I were God, I'd sentence it to hell. If I were Pope, my pleasure and my fame would come from scamming Christians well. And if I were Emperor, know what? I'd find some necks to cut. If I were Death, I'd fly to my father's bed. If I were Life, I'd flee from him instead. And to my mother, I'd do the same. If Cecco were, as it was and is, my name, I'd take the women who are young and lovely and leave for others the old and ugly. I'll finish with this one, a bit of light verse. This is an example of what is a new genre, a rising genre in poetry, some of you might have heard of, called spoetry. And it's poetry that is composed of the language of spam. Email spam, that is. Typically, it's poetry that's constructed out of the subject lines of spam. And it's a really satisfying thing to work on because you're taking the stuff that just annoys you, arrives in your inbox, and you can't do anything about it, and you're making something out of it. So it appealed to me. And I noticed when I was reading around and first stumbled across this that all of the spoetry that I could find, and if you Google it, you'll find a lot, is free verse. I didn't see any formal spoetry, so I thought, well, this will be my contribution to the genre of spoetry. And I thought, well, what would be an appropriate form? And I played with it for a while and thought, it's got to be a repeating form, clearly, for this. And I finally settled on the Pantoum. So this is a poem called Spamtoum. And I did tweak some of the lines for meter, I have to admit. But the rhymes are all the same. And I tried to preserve the spirits of the originals, even when I had to change a few of the words. It starts with a dedicatory stanza. I don't know if you've noticed, but spam goes through these cycles. And a couple years ago, there was a cycle where you were getting spam from people with really funny names. It doesn't seem to be so much. At least I'm not getting that anymore. I'm kind of bored now. I'm just getting mostly spam that has to do with online pharmacy and, you know, ordering drugs. And it's gotten to be almost only that for me for some reason. It must be the filter. But anyway, these are a few names that I've actually come across, either because I got mail from them or friends did and forwarded it to me. For Camshaft Cohen, Earlene Gee, Cook Bullocks, Busby Salazar, and this is my favorite, Spigot P. Toxicity, and others who know who they are. The last wish of a dying man. Get an iPod Nano free. Cheap Viagra. Tryptophan. Why are you ignoring me? Get an iPod Nano free. Do you wish for lager breasts? Typo in the original. Why are you ignoring me? I need to get this off my chest. Do you wish for lager breasts? their beautiful-looking rich chiffon. I need to get this off my chest. Urgent message from Amazon. Their beautiful-looking rich chiffon. This could be your Lucy Day. Urgent message from Amazon. Cut your bills the Christian way. This could be your Lucy Day. This thing here could change your life. Cut your bills the Christian way. Hide cable watching from your wife. This thing here could change your life. Trojans everywhere, slay them all. Hide cable watching from your wife. Aha, your penis is so small. Trojans everywhere, slay them all. My sylvan swim, go private snog. Ha ha, your penis is so small. You fat ass, stochastic frog. My sylvan swim, go private snog. You've been sent an insta-kiss. You fat ass, stochastic frog. Get rid of messages like this.